Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This podcast is for listeners who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi, a PhD candidate at Princeton University. Today we are here to talk to Professor Nenke Bohr, the author of The Briny South, Displacement and Sentiment in the Indian Ocean World, published by Duke University Press in 2023. Nenke Bohr is a lecturer in world literatures in English at the University of Sydney. In The Briny South, Bohr examines the legal and literary narratives of enslaved, indentured, and imprisoned individuals crossing the Indian Ocean, to analyze the formation of racialized identities in the imperial world. Drawing on court records, ledgers, pamphlets, census reports, newsletters, folk songs, memoirs, among others, and South African and South Asian works of fiction and autobiography, Bohr theorizes the role of sentiment and the depiction of emotions to the construction of identities of displaced peoples across the Indian Ocean. From the Dutch East India Company rule in the 17th and 18th centuries to early apartheid South Africa, Bohr shows how colonial powers and settler states mediated and manipulated subaltern expressions of emotion as a way to silence racialized subjects and portray them as inarticulately suffering. In this way, sentiment operated in favor of the powerful rather than as an oppositional weapon of the subaltern. By tracing the entwinement of displacement, race, and sentiment, Bohr frames the Indian Ocean as a site of subjugation within a long history of transnational connection and exploitation. Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book today.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me on here. It's a great honor.
It's ours. We would like first to learn about yourself. You can say a few words about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you became interested in your field of study, and if you had any mentors you would like to mention.
Oh, great. Thank you. So I was born in South Africa, but I grew up mostly in Namibia and Swaziland, now Eswatini. I guess I always tell my students I have a really boring origin story. I sort of heard about the discipline of comparative literature in high school, and I decided that was what I wanted to do. And then I went to college and studied comparative literature. I had sort of the privilege of working with Simon Gikandi there. This was at Princeton. And then I went to graduate school and continued to do comparative literature. So I didn't really change my mind very much. So in graduate school, I worked with Mark Saunders, who also works on South African literature, and he works on law and literature. So that was quite influential on my work. And then, of course, Isabel Hoffmeyer, she was also there. This was at NYU. And so I met her there, and you know, that was really sort of, she's been the most amazing mentor, I have to say. Isabel is very generous. Just in terms of sort of Indian Ocean studies, I've also sort of met with and worked with Gaurav Desai, Pallavi Rastogi, and then Meg Samuelson. And they've also just been sort of great mentors. So I think, yeah, I've just been really lucky in terms of my mentors.
That's quite the A-list you have there. We had some of these on the podcast. So if listeners are interested, just look up their names on New Books Network.
Yeah, that's true. I was just listening to Isabel's podcast, and it was great.
Yeah, it's great. I would like to know more in terms of what drew you to the Indian Ocean world as a framework for reading all of these texts.
I kind of got interested in college. I sort of did the more traditional comparative literature route of, like, I learned German and French and sort of was working on those kind of languages. But then after college, I spent a year in India. I was just working for an NGO there for a year and started learning some Hindi just a little bit and really wanted to sort of expand on that and wanted to do comparative literature between India and South Africa. But then, you know, when I started sort of refining my project, I just came across this field of Indian Ocean Studies and was really drawn to sort of the more historical aspects of links between India and South Africa. So, you know, that kind of got me into the field of Indian Ocean Studies.
I see. Can you say more about the title, The Brainy South? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I was sort of, you know, I work in Indian Ocean Studies and Ocean Studies more broadly, and I also teach classes in Ocean Studies more broadly. And also I've been sort of drawn to new work in Global South Studies, so work by people like Anne Garland Mahler and Magali Armias Teixeira. On Global South Studies in literature specifically. And so I was asked to sort of write an article about how Ocean Studies fits into Global South Studies, you know, what the two fields can offer each other. And so, you know, I sort of thinking about this, I came up with this concept of the Briny South, which is the intersection of these two fields of study. So it combines sort of the interest in deep historical study and attention to individuals moving across oceans from ocean studies with the sort of interest in specifically looking at subaltern individuals that Global South Studies is very interested in. And it's sort of Global South Studies allows us to move beyond some of the post-colonial studies frameworks and think about the world sort of more globally and also about contemporary sort of neo-colonial kind of interactions. And so, yeah, I just sort of coined this term for that intersection and the kind of work that people are doing at that intersection of these two fields.
That was helpful. Why did you focus on displacement and sentiment among other themes?
Yeah, so sentiment became sort of a key term quite early on. When I talk about sentiment here, I know there's like sort of a long history of, you know, talking about sentiments and what the term means at different moments in history. I'm using it quite simply to sort of distinguish sort of actual emotions felt by individuals, which I argue that especially with sort of these historical subjects I study, we have no access to distinguish those emotions from the way that their emotions were depicted in writing. So sentiments for me is just sort of the artful literary depiction of emotions. And so that became quite important to me because I was looking at these sort of different texts, specifically when I was looking at the sort of early Dutch court records, and I was sort of amazed by the fact that these enslaved individuals were sort of were depicted in these records, like their supposed exact words expressing their emotions were recorded in these court records. And that sort of tied in with some of the work I was doing in later chapters too. So that focus on sentiment and how the way that subaltern emotions were depicted both in court records, in sort of legal writing, in formal writing, and then later in autobiography and fiction, that sort of became sort of a central question to me. Displacement was sort of just a sort of default factor of the kind of groups that I was studying. I was really interested in people in motion. And the individuals in my book were all sort of like forced or put into motion by empire. And so the fact that they were displaced was sort of one of the connecting themes between these three groups. So enslaved persons, indentured persons, and then war prisoners.
So by focusing on these categories of displacement, what do you think scholars of the Indian Ocean can learn?
I'm so sorry, can you repeat that?
By focusing on these three categories that you've mentioned of enslaved, indentured, and interned, what can the scholars of the Indian Ocean learn in terms of thinking about mobility and immobility within imperial frameworks?
Thanks for that question. Sorry, I couldn't hear it first. What does this add to sort of Indian Ocean studies more broadly? I think Indian Ocean studies has initially started as sort of a historical framework, right? And so it often focused on individuals in motion, but I think a lot of the early work were on terms of merchants and other individuals like crossing the ocean sort of out of their own free will. Part of what this sort of adds to it is looking at unfree migration, right? Because it's harder to write about these subjects because they most frequently did not leave any of their own sort of autobiographical writing. So we're reliant on these imperial archives. So for me, that was, you know, one of the things that drew me to these subjects was the fact that almost like it was a challenge. There was so little information available.
Right. And thinking about these categories, we often think about the famous work, Can the Subaltern Speak? So how did you tackle the issue of uncovering or voicing these individuals in the text that you read and analyzed?
I think actually originally my subtitle was going to be Silence and Speech in the Indian Ocean World. So that was one of the titles I was sort of playing with. And that's because, so this idea of how individuals are portrayed as speaking and in which ways they are silenced is sort of one of the key questions that run throughout the texts. So I mentioned the book that I take Spivak's question and I sort of alter it a bit to ask, like, can the subaltern be depicted as speaking? Because the answer is different, at least initially in these sort of early Dutch court records, as I mentioned, the enslaved are depicted as speaking and there is sort of no issue with them being able to speak in court and like have their supposed direct speech recorded. And then what changes later in the sort of 19th century, once the sort of British take over, the court records still exist, but it's interesting how the enslaved are increasingly sort of paraphrased, right? They're not depicted as speaking directly in the same way. And that sort of echoes what happens in abolitionist discourse. And so that sort of question of like not whether the subaltern can speak, because I think, you know, Spivak has sort of answered that quite definitively for us, but whether in legal, literary, fictional imaginations, they are imagined as speaking or depicted as speaking, seems to me to open up sort of a different line of inquiry.
That's useful to think with. Thank you. Let's now turn to the book and its chapters. The book consists of five chapters with an introduction and a coda at the end. At first glance, I see a periodization from the mid-17th century till the end of the 19th century. It might be obvious why you pick this periodization, but can you elaborate on that more?
Yeah, so it sort of spans the period of, it begins with sort of the European arrival at the Dutch Cape of Good Hope and then ends in 1960. So, you know, shortly after the imposition of apartheid legislation in South Africa. And I guess I'm just lucky as a literary scholar to be able to cover this sort of vast period of time. I think, you know, if, as a historian, one would probably be expected to be slightly more focused in your work. But I was really trying to tell sort of a long-term story about displacement sentiment and law in this sort of exchanges between South Asia, Southeast Asia, and South Africa. So for me, it was important to sort of cover, you know, all these different kinds of imperial and then like post-imperial but still racialized rule that starts in the 1950s in South Africa.
While going through this long durée, did you feel any tension between historical studies and literary studies and thinking about time?
In general, I think yes. I think a lot of people in literary studies, I often get asked why so much of my book is talking about, you know, what they think of as historical sources. But I actually think that the sort of tension was really productive for me because, you know, it really forced me to think about, you know, there are historians writing about these texts and these individuals, and they're doing, like, they've produced really great works. So the question for me is, what can a literary scholar do with these records that, you know, a historian might not think to do, right? So really bringing those skills of close reading and literary analysis to bear on texts which, you know, they contain information, but they can also be close read to reveal sort of different things. In terms of, I think you said, like, specifically in terms of time and, you know, how the fact that this is such a sort of long period of time to talk about, I think I felt a lot of pressure to really, you know, study up on the periods that I was working on, the different sort of periods. So, you know, I had my, like, you know, year of becoming an 18th centuryist, which I realized it's not enough time to become a proper 18th centuryist or a proper sort of 19th centuryist in another year. But I felt like I really had to try and immerse myself as much as possible in these periods so that the claims that I make could be both true, could hold up to historians of that period and literary scholars of that period, while still being sort of, focused on the present as well, and sort of like looking back at the past from the present moment.
Right. So in the first chapter, representing speech and bondage and the court records of the Dutch Cabo de Goedhoop, you would say in Dutch, Is that correct?
Yes, Cabo de Goede Hoop.
I'm trying to remember my time at Leiden, and I've learned some of
just all the way through.
Yes, from 1652 to 1795. What are the analytical tools that you draw on to think about representation and specifically representation of speech in these texts? Usually, when we think about representation of speech, you wouldn't really apply these methods, I would say. Usually by historians, they wouldn't apply these methods in thinking about legal records. So what do you think the utility of your experience in this chapter could be for scholars thinking about court records in the Indian Ocean?
Yeah, I think that's really sort of where the sort of literary training helped as well, right? Because these are really fascinating records, and one can, you know, you can read them, and historians have read them so much for, like, information about how individuals lived back then, sort of demographic information. Just, you can just read them, like, they're just so interesting by themselves. But then the kind of analysis that I did was, sort of asking a very literary question, which is, like, why is speech at certain moments, like, represented in quotation marks almost, right? You know, as direct, quoted direct speech, rather than as paraphrasing, right? Like, why would lawmakers make that specific choice in writing these texts? Because, you know, we know from studies of, you know, the way people, like, even it's never like an actual accurate depiction of speech, right? It's always a imagination or a representation of that speech. Why is that how they choose to represent it? And like, so the entire chapter sort of emerges from what I think is a very sort of like literary, like close reading kind of question. Why speech not paraphrased here? Why is it quoted directly? And that, you know, like, so I can use sort of reading all of these, you know, I'm sort of reading the court records in a way that allows me to look for sort of literary features, right? Rather than just facts or information.
And someone can think of also a parallel in the Atlantic world for the Inquisition records. And the scholars of the Atlantic have also tried to think about, I guess, representation in those records, as well as you might think about other sources that one can study in the Indian Ocean to think about representation of speech. That's really interesting. And then we go to the second chapter, which almost speak back to the first chapter, which is silencing the enslaved. Here we are thinking about the act of silencing rather than just representation of speech, and the aesthetics of abolitionism in the British Cape Colony between 1795 to 1834. And thinking about silencing, we think about an active process here of censorship rather than representing and quoting maybe the subaltern. How do you define silencing, and how do you think about this active process of reconfiguring the enslaved in the legal records?
So I think the two first two chapters really, as you say, they sort of like they make sense when read next to each other, because the almost the weirdness or the interestingness of those earlier Dutch records where you have these frequent sort of direct quotations really only becomes clear when you look at these later sort of 19th century records, where you still have one of the sort of interesting features about the Cape was that in these courts you could have the enslaved and free are tried by the same courts, and they can act as witnesses, the accused, the accusers, and that's very unusual in British colonies more broadly, where you tend to have separate slave courts. And so these kind of records that I'm looking at, they just don't exist in the same way for much of the other sort of British colonies. But because at the Cape, the British just sort of took over the Dutch legal system, they continued these courts. So you have these great court records. You have pages and pages and pages of sort of like transcripts from sort of sentences and you can really notice the difference in the way that these direct like exclamations, these quotations by the enslaved, you just don't find them anymore. They're often just sort of paraphrased. So it's sort of, again, it's one of those, it's a small observation to note that you have fewer like representations of direct quotations, but it led me to ask this bigger question of how were the enslaved represented as speaking in the Cape more broadly, and that led me to some of the abolitionist writing from the Cape, and Thomas Pringle is the most well-known abolitionist, and just sort of close reading some of his texts, a lot of which talks a lot about the enslaved and is trying to definitely raise sympathy and awareness of the enslaved, but so often they are just described, right? They're described as crying, they're described as suffering, but they're not, you don't hear in quotation marks, because I realize this is all just represented speech, but you don't hear them in the same way. So there is that sort of similarity in the way that the court records function, in which the abolitionist sort of writing functions, and then there's this sort of pretty interesting but horrific document by a slaveholder also from the Cape, and you notice sort of the same trend there. So there's this overlap in which, in the way that both the abolitionist and the pro-slavery activists are writing about the enslaved. And so that, I guess, sort of just led me to ask broader questions about sort of representation of the enslaved and what I call sort of the aesthetics of slavery, thinking about, you know, some of the artwork that emerges from the 19th century, some of the sort of more well-known Atlantic sort of abolitionist works. And so I just conclude by reflecting more broadly upon how the enslaved are represented in these texts.
That's really useful for me because I'm working now with basically quoted enslaved individuals. However, their names are erased, and the speech and the representation, as well as silencing some of their intended meanings, are really quite obvious in the text. And it's good to see a parallel elsewhere to think about. So we move from speech and representation and silencing to the sentimental in the last three chapters of the book. In chapter three, between quotations, grievances more sentimental than material, representing indentured labor in Natal between 1860 to 1915. And chapter four, a sentimental education in Boer War imprisonment camps in South Asia between 1899 to 1902. And chapter five, sentiment and the law in early South African Indian writing between 1893 to 1960. So in these three chapters, we move to different sets of sources, different set of questions. And thinking about the sentimental in these different histories and texts, would you see as common running themes in these chapters in thinking about the sentimental? And what sort of challenges you face in reading these different sources comparing to the previous two legal sources?
Yeah, so chapter three is kind of, bridging, sort of moving from the legal sources to more autobiographical sources, which is chapter four and chapter five. So in chapter three, the overarching question, you know, that runs throughout is quite simple, like who can speak and how, right? And so I move historically after the end of slavery, the British Empire and other empires turned to indenture as a source of labor. And so I start by comparing the way that abolitionists could write about the enslaved, specifically Pringle writing about the enslaved at the Cape, to how Gandhi, who, you know, as everyone on this podcast knows, spent a lot of time in South Africa, how he can write about indentured laborers, right? And one of the things that, you know, like that's where the quotation comes from, he's accused that the grievances that he raises about British Indians in South Africa are more sentimental than material, by which they mean sort of more imagined than real or experienced. And so he's writing about these the experience of British Indians in South Africa, he really has to stress sort of the material aspects of their oppression and their suffering, rather than sort of what they call sentimental or like feelings, language of feelings, right? So when he talks about the insults that are lobbied against Indians in South Africa, he has to show how each insult translates into like actual physical injury, whether that is damage to a shop or like damage to someone's like body. So he really has to sort of physicalize the way that he talks about that experience. And that leads to the way that he also talks about indentured laborers, which is quite different than the way that abolitionists can talk about the enslaved sort of, what, 70 years earlier or so. There's been this sort of a shift in how the suffering has to be portrayed. And so he has this very intricate balance where he talks about, you know, both the actual physical suffering of this indentured laborer that he's representing in court. But then he does shift constantly between sort of language of emotions and sentiments and like physical grievances, but he has to be so careful in the way that he frames that. So then I cross-referenced that with some other court cases of indentured laborers. So that's sort of, you know, the last bit of time I spent in the court records, and sort of see a similar thing where these records really focus on like physical grievances, like physical suffering rather than emotions, right? Like that kind of like language of emotions has to be sort of strategically erased for their complaints to be legible. So yeah, like that was, you know, that again, having these two chapters to compare with each other is quite useful because you can see that shift. Then the last two chapters, as I say, sort of move more into autobiography and eventually fiction. So the chapter on South African Boer War prisoners, you know, is kind of a departure from the earlier chapters. But I think it helps to tell sort of the whole story because, you know, here you literally see expressions of sentiment being censored. They have these like long lists of records of letters from these war internment camps in South Asia. And the things that like get censored out, that get, you know, like aren't allowed through us are specifically sort of like expressions of emotion, negative emotion, like negative sentiments against the British, complaints. And the ones that, you know, like get a check that like are recorded as positive are the ones talking about how well the British treat them, etc. And then you kind of see how like the memoirs that these individuals write afterwards continue this trend of sort of, I say they sort of inhabit more a traveler mentality rather than a sufferer, like a war prisoner mentality. But then later, the memoirs written sort of in the 1930s and 40s, which are part of this big moment of sort of Afrikaner nationalist consolidation, you see all of these like repressed sentiments for the land sort of like being resurrected and deployed to help strengthen this claim of like Boer war suffering and Afrikaner like righteous claims to the land, right? So it becomes sort of deployed in this very sort of nationalist and like racial manner, which then leads us into the final chapter, where we see how these kind of sort of sentimental claims to the land, which are at the heart of like apartheid ideology, like these kind of claims are used against the sort of descendants of indentured laborers and the enslaved, who are seen as like are described in these apartheid records as like being foreign, right? Like as not having a right to belong in South Africa. So yeah, sort of and then, you know, like that same chapter, I look at how in order to sort of counteract these kind of claims of not belonging, of being perpetual outsiders, of being alien. You see South Asian would-be settlers in South Africa writing what I call sort of like settler narratives, right? Where they use tropes that we are familiar with from settler novels to try and stake a kind of sentimental claim to the land. But it, you know, like this is like, these are these odd kind of texts where these individuals can't really like fully like make that sentimental claim because like language of outsiderness, of the indenture contract, of that sort of precarity that keeps on intruding on the narratives.
I'm curious now thinking about the fictional and non-fictional in the five chapters and how do we relate that to the question of intentionality? So how did you navigate that question, I guess, in reading between these different genres?
Yeah. I guess so. Questions of intentionality in sort of reading autobiography versus fiction. You know, I kind of, it's a tough question. I think that, you know, when I read the I don't actually spend that much time on fiction, and I'm sort of hoping to rectify that with my next project. But I, you know, I kind of look for similar patterns, because even in an autobiography, and I kind of read Gandhi's autobiography, for example, next to a novel by a South African Indian, Ansoya R. Singh. You know, I kind of think of Gandhi as much sort of, you know, like fictionalizing his life, like creating a story of his life, as Singh is in creating this like entirely fictional Indian family in South Africa. So, you know, I kind of treat autobiography as also just, even if it's a representation of the self, still a representation, especially when it comes to thinking of questions of sort of emotions, right? And how like the sort of genre that one is working with, right? Like, so even like the sort of pressures of like autobiography as a genre forces you to deploy certain kind of sentiments and tropes.
Mm-hmm. Finally, we move to the coda, No Human Footprints. Here we move from the imperial Indian Ocean to the present. What did you mean by no human footprints, and what would you like to convey through this coda?
Yeah, I think the coda was just, yeah, so as you say, sort of trying to bring it up to the present moment. And I look at the Chagos Archipelago, which is sort of like, you know, this like last trace of empire. Empire still hasn't set, the sun still hasn't set on the British Empire there. Like, you still have the Indian, it's called the Indian Ocean, British Indian Ocean Territory. As the sort of contemporary scene of forced displacement, as the sort of Chagossians have been, who are largely the descendants of indentured laborers and enslaved persons, right? And they've been sort of displaced and forced to move to Mauritius and elsewhere. And I'm looking at the kind of rhetoric that the British, Foreign Services is still using to justify this. And there is these fascinating records which refer to the archipelago as, you know, sort of Robinson Crusoe's island, right? They use this language of like, no human footprint shall be found here. So just kind of thinking about how like the legacies of the way that, you know, islands, imperial islands were imagined in fiction, like how that still influences sort of legal discourse and like realities of life today. So just to sort of, you know, stress that, you know, this is not just a sort of story of history, but this is very much continuing today, the way that like sentiment and this kind of depiction of sentiment is used even today to render certain people silent.
Indeed. So who would you hope will read this book, and what sort of impact would you like it to have?
That's a great question. I hope anyone reads it. I think I was telling you earlier, like one writes a book and it sort of goes out in the world, and it's hard to imagine anyone actually reading it. So thank you so much for your careful reading of it. It's been great talking to you about this. I hope that it is useful to both historians and literary theorists. People who are interested in the Indian Ocean, but also I think, you know, just as a contrast to the Black Atlantic and the kind of work that's so much work that has been done on the Black Atlantic, I think this should hopefully also be of interest to scholars of slavery more broadly in other parts of the world. I hope that also that it engages with this ongoing question of how do we work with these imperial archives, right? Not just as historians, but in this case, as a literary theorist, like how can we sort of read these very like violent archives, and you know, what can we do with the records that we find there? And so I hope that would be sort of broader interest to other people who are engaging with imperial archives, other kinds of archives, just about sort of different kinds of questions that one can ask of those documents.
Right. And I would like to refer our listeners to another podcast with Professor Ronit Ricci about her book, Banishment and Belonging, which would be really a good pair, I think, with this book on any syllabus. Well, thank you so much. We've taken a lot of your time, and we move now to our final traditional question, which is what are you working on now or hope to work on? Can you tell us about your current and future projects?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, as I said, I'm trying to sort of address my lack of fiction in the earlier book. While I was working on these documents and working in these archives, I noticed that there was, you know, a number of sort of like contemporary fiction writers were also sort of turning to the same archives of displacement and subaltern speech that I was turning to in order to write sort of fictional works. And so I kind of became fascinated with these sort of very contemporary, like post-2000 novels that are also really interested in depicting like subaltern figures in movement, so sort of transnational subaltern figures. So I'm sort of tentatively working on something I call like the Global South novel, arguing that this is sort of a newer emerging form of historical fiction that engages sort of seriously with archives to focus on these sort of subaltern figures who become the protagonists and that have these kind of rich transnational journeys. I mean, everyone on here would know Amitav Ghosh's Sea of Poppies, and I kind of think of that as the Ur text in this sort of canon. But it's sort of a return to, like, you know, realist depictions of history that focus on displacement, but from below.
That sounds fascinating, and I look forward to having you again on the podcast.
Great, yeah, that would be. Thank you for having me.
Sure, yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for listening to today's episode, in which we explored The Briny South, Displacement and Sentiment in the Indian Ocean World, published by Duke University Press in 2023. This is your host, Ahmed Elmazmi. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.